From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a private eye in the Louisiana Bayou. We talk with James Lee Burke about his series of crime novels set in and around New Orleans. In his new book, Detective Dave Robichaux investigates a TV evangelist and an ex-Klansman turned politician. Also, White Men Can't Jump. We talk with Ron Shelton, the writer and director of this new film about basketball and con games. Shelton also wrote and directed Bull Durham. And TV critic David Bianculli tells us about two new cable specials featuring James Taylor and Bob Newhart. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Former tennis star Arthur Ashe says he has AIDS. At a news conference in New York this afternoon, Ashe said he believes he contracted the AIDS virus from a blood transfusion following open-heart surgery. NPR's Brenda Wilson reports.
Arthur Ashe says he learned that he was HIV positive after a 1988 operation for paralysis in his right hand. Laboratory reports indicated toxoplasmosis, an opportunistic infection related to the AIDS virus. Ashe says that he only went public today after being confronted by the USA Today newspaper, which learned of his condition through an unnamed source. Ashe says his doctors are almost certain that he became infected from a transfusion after a 1983 heart bypass operation. He says that neither his wife nor his daughter are infected. Ash is the second major sports figure to announce that he is infected with the AIDS virus. Magic Johnson made a similar revelation just 5 months ago. In 1968, Ash made tennis history when he won the U.S. Open and became the first black man to win one of the sport's Grand Slam tournaments. I'm Brenda Wilson.
Labor Secretary Lynn Martin said today that President Bush supports an extension of emergency unemployment benefits through this year's election season. Martin said the president hopes to reach agreement with Congress to extend jobless compensation beyond the current expiration date on the 4th of July. The secretary said that President Bush will not support any measure that breaks the budget agreement with Congress or makes any changes in the basic rules. That would include a measure introduced last week by Democratic Representative Thomas Downey of New York. Downey's measure would provide as much as 20 weeks of extra benefits to 1.5 million unemployed Americans. The Senate is considering a proposal to cut next year's defense budget by $8 billion. The effort comes as the Senate debates an overall 1993 budget of $1.5 trillion. NPR's Neil Conan has a report.
Proposing the amendment, Democrat James Exon of Nebraska described it as a modest reduction. The bulk of his proposed cuts would come from procurement, the stuff the Pentagon wants to buy, and Senator Exon described administration charges that his cuts would force the dismissal of hundreds of thousands of troops as part of an artful, emotionally charged, yet inherently dishonest snow job. But Senator Exon also conceded that he did not expect his amendment to pass. A similar proposal was voted down by a solid phalanx of Republicans and some Democrats in the Budget Committee last week, and any hopes of a different result in the full Senate disappeared when Senate Armed Services Committee Chairman Sam Nunn of Georgia, also a Democrat, said he would vote against it. Nunn said that cuts are already going ahead as quickly as they can without disrupting the armed forces, and that deeper cuts in procurement would cost the jobs of thousands of defense workers. This is Neil Conan at the Capitol.
Stock prices fell sharply today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 32 points to close at 3,181.35. Declines led advances by 13-4. This is NPR. The Yugoslav Federal Army and Air Force have launched attacks in the newly independent Republic of Bosnia-Herzegovina. The Serbian-dominated army intervened in ethnic fighting between Serbs, who are a minority in Bosnia, and a majority coalition of Muslims and Croats. The Muslims and Croats support independence, while the ethnic Serbs want to remain part of the Yugoslav Federation. The Serbs have declared their own independence in the parts of Bosnia that they control. The Federal Army said it had captured a strategically valuable town and surrounded Sarajevo, the Bosnian capital. After 4 days of deliberations, the jury in the Miami drug and racketeering trial of former Panamanian leader Manuel Noriega is deadlocked. Melissa Mancini reports from Miami.
In a note to U.S. District Court Judge William Hoover, the jury foreman wrote, "We have a serious problem. We are deadlocked." The foreman said one of the 12 jurors had made up their mind 2 days ago and that the rest of them felt like they were wasting time. He asked the judge for help. Judge Hoover responded by saying it was too soon for them to give up. If the jury cannot arrive at a unanimous decision on any of the counts, a mistrial will be declared and Noriega will be retried. Panama's former military leader is accused in a 10-count federal indictment of turning his country into a way station for drugs on their way to the United States. He faces up to 160 years in prison and over $1 million worth of fines if found guilty on all charges. For National Public Radio, I'm Melissa Mancini in Miami.
Britain charged today that Iraq has violated the Gulf War ceasefire accords by moving anti-aircraft missiles into the Kurdish area of northern Iraq. The office of Prime Minister John Major said that Iraq has moved missile batteries into the area that's being patrolled by U.S., British, and French aircraft. Major met today with General Colin Powell, the chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Cajun detective Dave Robichaud is the creation of my guest James Lee Burke. His novels are set in New Orleans and the surrounding bayou. Joyce Carol Oates reviewed Burke's new book for The Washington Post. She included him among the gifted contemporary writers responsible for revitalizing the detective genre by bringing in issues of politics, gender, race, and morality. Oates writes, among even his talented contemporaries, Burke is something special. Burke got a late start in the field of crime fiction. His first novel was published in 1965, but he went through long periods when no one was interested in bringing out his books. One book was in play for 9 years and was rejected by 100 publishers. It wasn't until the mid-80s that Burke started writing detective novels. In his new novel, A Stained White Radiance, Dave Robichaud is investigating a Klansman-turned-politician and a TV evangelist. Here's a reading.
If you grew up in the Deep South, you're probably fond, as I am, of recalling the summertime barbecues and fish fries, the smoke drifting in the oak trees, the high school dances under a pavilion that was strung with Japanese lanterns, the innocent lust we discovered in convertibles by shattered lakes groaning with bullfrogs, and the sense that the season was eternal, that the world was a quiet and gentle place, that life was a party to be enjoyed with the same pleasure and certainty as the evening breeze that always carried with it the smell of lilac and magnolia and watermelons in a distant field. But there is another memory, too. The boys who went nigger knocking in the little black community of Sunset, who shot people of color with BB guns and marbles fired from slingshots, who threw M-80s onto the galleries of their pitiful homes. Usually these boys had burr haircuts, jug ears, half moons of dirt under their fingernails. They lived in an area of town with unpaved streets, garbage in the backyards, ditches full of mosquitoes and water moccasins from the coulee. Each morning they got up with their loss, their knowledge of who they were, and went to war with the rest of the world. When we meet the adult bigot, the Klansman, the anti-Semite, we assume that he was bred in that same wretched place. Sometimes that's a correct conclusion. Oftentimes it's not.
Do you know anybody who you grew up with who you feel became as an adult one of the kinds of fascists that you're writing about?
Oh, I knew many people who grew up to be like the boys that I describe here in this piece, but these kinds of people are victims themselves. These are fellas, or sometimes women too, who are inept and not quite functional and see themselves as being disenfranchised, and they never know who they are unless they feel superior to some other group, and they're by and large innocuous and bumbling guys with banana peels for fingers. It's hard to look upon them as villains. They're almost like buffoons rather than villainous people. The kind of individual who bothers me most is the one who's calculating, who knows better, and who is of insidious intent. the person who perhaps has sociopathic tendencies, who insinuates himself into the mainstream of society. And he has one message always. He teaches others to fear and to hate our fellow man and to blame others for our own misfortune.
Now, Dave Robichaux, your detective, is drawn to people who are psychologically deformed in some way. I mean, he considers people like that to be like his extended family. the walking wounded, as he describes them. Is that an affinity you feel yourself?
Well, let's face it, who are the most interesting people in our midst? People who get up every morning and do things in a normal way, or the deeply neurotic and brain fried, the people who begin each day with a nervous breakdown, people who were shot out of a cannon 5 minutes ago. I think they're always more intriguing. I don't know. I've always felt that it's difference that saves us from ourselves. I mean, God help us if we ever become too enamored with normalcy. It's always the person who has the outrageous and eccentric view of the world who leads us away from ourselves, always. Whether it's, we're talking about Newton or Christ or Socrates, it's always the person who does everything backwards, who says no to the status quo, that has something to say. Bernard Shaw once said, "We learn from the irrational man and woman. They reject the world as it is. They do not adapt themselves to it. They seek to change it.
I want to just quote a line from your new novelist, Stand White Radiance, and this is in a paragraph where Dave Robichaux, your detective, is talking about how his extended family is people who have a peculiar difference in their makeup. Mm-hmm. And he's talking about every time he thinks that some kind of constitutional sacrifice can be justified for the greater good, he wonders what his eccentric friends would say. And he says, then I realized that the rhetoric of the greater good, would have no effect on them, because for those who were most deeply injured as children, words of moral purpose too often masked acts of cruelty.
That's right.
Tell me how that observation came to you.
Well, anyone who spends any time, with 12-step groups or in analytical therapy or analysis is going to discover something about the nature of cruelty and how oftentimes it masks itself as love. And we all, at some time in our lives, have to deal with the nature of power and authority. And so very often people who suffer the greatest psychological injury in their lives are those who were treated erratically as children, not in a way that was consistently abusive. They were often hurt in some way, psychologically, physically, but were constantly told that this was an act of love, that it was being done for the child's own good. That person grows up with his head in a microwave. And the consequence is, as a rule, he has trouble with authority, defining it. He may spend a lifetime rebelling against it, or he may embrace it. He probably will misuse power himself. And one theme in the book deals with how an injury done a child is like a stone bruise, and it perpetuates itself in the person's adult life, where the injury is compounded, and it. This is why, you know, forgiveness and atonement and reconciliation among ourselves, to my mind at least, is so important. That person doesn't have to play the hand he's dealt with. You can put it away and say, "How about 5 new cards?"
We were talking a little earlier about how crime fiction has really become the genre that's really about moral questions. Because the detective is always faced with moral questions and has to decide when it's just to kind of fudge things on the law and when it's not, and when just kind of analyzing the character of others and who is kind of morally just and who isn't, and so on. And it's also become like the novel of sensibility because you're always seeing things through the detective's eyes. I wonder if since writing crime fiction yourself, and it's only been, I think, less than 10 years.
Oh, yeah.
That you've been writing
six.
This detective series. Yeah. Have you started thinking more about, like, morality and ethics than you ever did before?
Well, that's a very good question. I think I've always written about the same kinds of people and situations, and I have never really made much of a distinction in kinds of writing, but I think your observation is just dead on correct. The contemporary crime novel, in many ways, is a form of primitive existentialism. The narrator, as you say, is almost a direct descendant of Poe's protagonist, Edgar Allan Poe's protagonist, in that he's a kind of intellectual outsider who sees a moral dilemma and a contest between good and evil in a way that seems sometimes to have almost apocalyptical proportions, because the landscape he describes is one that is at war with itself.
So how do you see the world differently now that you have to be looking at it through the eyes of your detective, Dave Robichaux?
Well, I don't think that I do. I subscribe to the notion that ultimately all our problems have to be confronted individually. I don't believe in institutional solutions. I think that's part of our contemporary self-delusion. Anyone who's ever been a victim of violent crime knows what I'm talking about. As Dave Robichaux observes, many of these people tend to become NRA members. I'm not an NRA member.
You mentioned people who've been the victims of violent crime. Does that include you? Have you ever been a victim?
My family has.
Can I ask what happened, what kind of crime it was that affected your family?
Well, my story's not significant. Everyone who's ever been in that territory knows what I'm talking about.
I understand that you don't want to talk about the incident that happened to your family, but I had already picked out a section where violence happens to in the home of Dave Robichaux, mm-hmm. your detective. And this is a scene in the second novel mm-hmm. that you wrote, the second Dave Robichaux novel, Heaven's Prisoners. And this is a scene in which his wife is killed by mm-hmm. people who are really looking for him. Mm-hmm. And I'd like for you to read that for
us. Okay, thanks. This is the second novel, as you say, in the series. The first one was The Neon Rain. In the first three books of the series, The Neon Rain, Heaven's Prisoners, and Black Cherry Blues form a trilogy. And the second book is the descent, really, into Dante's Ninth Ring when Dave loses his wife, Annie. This book, by the way, is being made into a film. Alec Baldwin's playing the lead, and Harley Payton from Twin Peaks wrote the screenplay, the adaptation. I raced through the front door into the bedroom and hit the light switch, my heart thundering in my chest. Red shotgun shells littered the doorway area. The mahogany foot and headboards of the bed were gouged and splintered with buckshot and deer slugs. The flowered wallpaper above the bed was covered with holes like black dimes. The sheet, which still lay over her, was drenched with her blood, the torn cloth embedded in wounds that wolves might have chewed. Her curly blonde hair was turned away from me on the pillow. One immaculate white hand hung over the side of the mattress. I touched her foot. I touched her blood-flecked ankle. I put my hands around her fingers. I brushed my palm across her curly hair. I knelt like a child by the bed and kissed her eyes. I picked her hand up and put her fingers in my mouth. Then the shaking started, like sinew and bone separating inside me, and I pressed my face tightly into the pillow with my wet hair against her forehead. I don't know how long I knelt there. I don't remember getting up from my knees. I know that my skin burned as though someone had painted it with acid, that I couldn't draw enough air into my lungs, that the room's yellow light was like a flame to my eyes, that all my joints seem atrophied with age, that my hands were blocks of wood when I fumbled in the dresser drawer, found the .45 and pushed the heavy clip into the magazine. In my mind's eye, I was already running through the yard, across my neighbor's pasture, through the sloping woods of oak and pine on the far side where the dirt road passed before it reached the drawbridge over the bayou.
Was that scene really hard to write?
Yeah, it sure was. That chapter was probably one of the most powerful that I ever wrote.
Because you must have felt this great affection for the character, as Dave did. I mean, you created her, and now you had decided that she had to die.
Well, I always feel the story is written in the unconscious.
Uh-huh.
That's always my feeling. I don't know how it's going. It's written somehow before the writer gets to it, and you discover the story as it unfolds day by day. It sounds a little schizoid, I'm afraid, but I believe that's about it.
My guest is James Lee Burke. He writes the Dave Robichaud detective novels. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is James Lee Burke, and he writes the Dave Robichaud crime novels, which are set in New Orleans. The new one is called A Stained White Radiance. I had read that you had an alcohol problem for a few years, and I was wondering if stopping coincided at all with your crime series and with the success of your fiction.
No. I belong to a 12-step fellowship today, but put it this way, through that fellowship, I learned a new point of view about many things. And the novels that have been very successful, the whole series narrated by Dave Robichaud, have as much to do with recovery as they do with social themes. And I receive hundreds of letters from people all over the country who tell me how much they received from the books, how much it helped them, or, in their opinion, how accurate the books are in describing recovery for people.
He's a recovering alcoholic.
Yeah, Dave is, sure. Yeah.
Was it helpful for you to have that character to write through some of the frustrations you might have been feeling and some of the cravings you might have had, you know, to kind of give it to the detective?
Well, is a catharsis? No, I appreciate your observation, but I don't think art is a catharsis. That therapists sometimes suggest that people paint or write. When I was teaching creative writing, some kid would sometimes enroll in my class and tell me the school counselor had concluded that he should take creative writing rather than be lobotomized. And I'd say, I would think, gee, thanks a lot for sending this guy into my class. But you simply, as a novelist, chronicle in one way or another part of your own experience, and if it's written correctly, honestly, it'll be an accurate representation of some of the psychological geography that people have to traverse.
I want to get back to your novel for a second.
Okay.
There's a group of characters who you describe in the novel as the pool.
Oh, yeah.
Let me ask you to describe the kind of person that you're talking about there and how you came up with that thought.
Well, I used to be a social worker in South Los Angeles, and the pool, these are the brain fried. These are the guys who, you know, arrive on this planet like, you know, a cannonball going through a stucco wall. They leave behind whole warehouses of paper, all kinds of records, parole and probation officers, marriage counselors, psychiatrists, social workers, bail bondsmen. These guys are the people with banana peels for fingers. And we think, my heavens, what are these guys doing in our society? But they provide employment for millions of other people, for guys like me who are such, who was, you know, a guy like me who was a social worker. People who complain most about these guys would be bereft if they disappeared, if the pool went away somewhere. I mean, how about all our, you know, policemen and psychiatrists, marriage counselors, what are they going to do for a job? That's on the kind of on the light side, but
you know, in a way, the way you're describing them, in a way, is not unlike the way you describe the kinds of eccentrics who
sure.
you're most interested in
yeah.
having as an almost extended family.
Yeah.
Are they the same people?
Sure, and I knew some great guys on Skid Row in Los Angeles. Yeah, East 5th Street, as Woody Guthrie once said, is the skiddiest of the skids. And there was this one guy, I won't use his name, but he was a master at manipulation. And he would come into the office and demand that we place him in our best hotels, you know, our welfare hotels. As soon as he checked in, he'd throw all the furniture out the window, box springs. One time he ripped the laboratory out of the wall. It'd come crashing, you know, down onto the cement from four stories high. And then he would run downstairs and haul it all to the secondhand store. This guy was...
Oh, to sell it.
To sell it. This guy was so infamous that in South L.A., the cops wouldn't arrest him because... This is kind of distasteful, but if they didn't cuff him right and he could get a finger down his throat, he'd throw up in the squad car.
Oh, God.
This guy was so awful, the jailer at Lincoln Heights didn't want him in his jail. He said, I couldn't take this guy anymore. This was, I mean, that's a victory, a guy that could undo the system the way this one man could.
So it sounds like your relationship with him was more of like a novelist to a character than a social
sure.
worker.
Sure. I knew hundreds of people like this guy, just truly extraordinary human beings.
Could you communicate with him?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Did you feel like you understood him?
Sure. And it's like any policeman will tell you that he knows many, many people like this man I describe. And that oftentimes there's a kind of symbiotic and sympathetic relationship between cops and certain kinds of people who inhabit the underworld. And they both sometimes understand the existentialistic rush that they get participating in a kind of nether society, a place that ordinary people don't put much time into. And that... You know, it's something interesting about being on the full tilt boogie all the time.
So when people could sense in you that you were not the straightest guy in the world, you know what I mean? That you were kind of eccentric yourself.
Well,
do you think? Well, but do you think that they would use that to try to take advantage of you,
no.
or do you think that they would have more of a feel more kind of sympathetic or affectionate toward you because of that?
Most people I knew in that world had a wink of the eye at mm-hmm. respectability, and if you could share it with them, they knew you both had a kind of a Sancho Panza view of things.
James Lee Burke, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me, Terry, on your show.
James Lee Burke's new book is called A Stained White Radiance. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, insults and con games on the basketball court. We talk with Ron Shelton, the writer and director of the new film White Men Can't Jump, starring Wesley Snipes and Woody Harrelson. Shelton also wrote and directed the baseball movie Bull Durham. And TV critic David Bianculli says if you like Bob Newhart's old stand-up routines, you won't want to miss his special coming up on Showtime. David has a preview. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Former tennis star Arthur Ashe announced this afternoon at a news conference in New York City that he has AIDS. Ashe says that he probably contracted the AIDS virus in 1983 during a second heart bypass operation when he was given a blood transfusion. Ashe says that he's known since 1988 that he had the AIDS virus, but did not go public earlier because of possible infringement upon his family's privacy. However, after he was contacted by a reporter this week, he decided to make his announcement. Ashe said his wife and daughter have tested HIV negative. Governor Bill Clinton left New York today for the state of Illinois, savoring a string of victories in yesterday's presidential primaries in Kansas, Wisconsin, and New York. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Although Clinton's victories brought his delegate total to well over half the 2,145 delegates he needs to win the nomination, there were troubling signs for Clinton in the results yesterday. In New York, nearly 60% of voters preferred other candidates, and there are indications that Clinton may not get the support in the fall from key groups of swing voters, independents and Democrats who voted for George Bush in 1988. And half of New York voters said Clinton didn't have the honesty or integrity to be president. Clinton was asked about that as he left New York this morning.
Well, how could they not? I mean, I'm swimming against a big tide of negative stuff that was dumped on me before I got here.
Clinton headed to Peoria, Illinois, where the big Caterpillar factory is on strike. His aides have planned a presidential-style visit during which Clinton will have meetings with both management and labor. In New York, I'm Mara Liasson.
A UN team has started to destroy an Iraqi nuclear complex. But as Iraq now abides by these ceasefire terms, there are new reports that it is violating others. NPR's Ann Garrels has this report.
The head of the UN inspection team says Iraq is complying, for now, with everything he is asking for. Iraq told inspectors earlier this week it would agree to the destruction of the Al-Athir nuclear complex. Meanwhile, though, U.S. and British officials say Iraq has moved anti-aircraft missiles north of the 36th parallel into the Kurdish zone protected by American, British, and French aircraft. The U.S. military has privately warned Iraq's military not to track Allied aircraft with the missile radar units. Earlier this week, following attacks by Iranian jets, Iraqi combat aircraft took to the skies for the first time since the Persian Gulf War. While concluding these flights outside the Kurdish security zone are technically not a violation of the ceasefire terms, the Pentagon has warned any Iraqi flights raise the risk of serious incident. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 32 points. This is NPR News. The State Department says that the Bush administration is allowing the export to Iran of two French-built airplanes equipped with U.S.-made engines. A spokeswoman denied this move is tied to the release last year of U.S. hostages held in Lebanon. Most exports to Iran are banned, but the engines and other American parts in the airplanes account for less than 20% of the foreign-made Airbuses. The State Department says these cases are decided on an individual basis. On Capitol Hill, a Senate Appropriations Subcommittee is looking into the rules governing President Bush's travel expenses. But the Bush administration says that presidential travel should be off-limits. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The cost of operating Air Force One is about $25,000 per hour. Senator Dennis DeConcini, an Arizona Democrat, says the taxpayers shouldn't have to pick up the bill when the president is mixing official business with politics.
I just think the public has a hard time seeing $200,000 or $300,000 spent on flying the president to three cities, two of them for political events and one for a very legitimate business expense, and the reimbursement is a couple thousand bucks, when in fact the cost is 20 or 30 times that.
But Budget Director Richard Darman says the American public thinks the president should maintain the dignity of the office. Another congressional hearing on White House perks is scheduled for tomorrow. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
Ethnic fighting continues in Bosnia, even as the government began putting together a small army for the newly independent state. Western governments are said to be putting pressure on the Yugoslav army, Croatia and Serbia, to try and end the factional fighting. This week, members of the European Community and the United States gave diplomatic recognition to Bosnia. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Ron Shelton used to play minor league baseball. He's gone a lot further as a filmmaker. His first movie, Bull Durham, took him back to the locker room of a minor league team. Shelton wrote and directed the film. His next movie, Blaze, went into the smoke-filled rooms of Louisiana politics. Shelton has returned to sports for the new film, White Men Can't Jump, about the homeboys who play basketball on the streets of L.A. This comedy stars Woody Harrelson and Wesley Snipes as two talented basketball players with an ingenious hustle that works off other players' racial stereotypes. Some of the ballplayers featured in the film are former NBA stars. The film is number one at the box office. Reviewing it in the New Yorker magazine, Terrence Rafferty called it a sane, savvy picture that's also unpredictable enough to produce more than a few moments of comic euphoria. Ron Shelton talked about the film with Fresh Air producer Amy Sallet. He told her why he wanted to make a film about playground basketball.
I'm just so fond of the world and the nonsense and the theater and the insulting and just sort of the whole emotional freedom of it that I thought I ought to try to capture it in a bottle before I was getting too old.
The dialogue that takes place in the movie on the court is very much a black street slang because it's mostly an all-black cast. And did you pick this up from the ball courts in L.A. to get the dialogue for the film?
Well, I have an easier time talking to my colleagues on the playground than I have talking to studio executives in Hollywood. So it's a language that I'm more familiar with because I grew up on the playgrounds and I grew up on the, at least in the, you know, in the locker room, in the whole world of jock private language. And of course, that's pretty heavily influenced by black street talk. But, you know, I just write what I hear. And in the rehearsal, a lot of the actors and I work together to kind of build riffs on dialogue that's scripted so that we can take off and go with it.
One of the common mind games that you show that goes on the court is using your mama insults, and you have a lot of them in the film. Did you make them up, or did you hear most of these, and could you tell us some of them that you hear?
Well, the mama jokes, of course, are a real playground staple and almost a time-honored ritual of insulting the other guy's mama, one that I've always been amused by, you know, having had a wonderful mother, defensive about. But I wrote the whole "Your Mom Was an Astronaut" riff is in the script, and it goes on and on and on. And in rehearsal, some of the actors started trying to top the "Your Mom Was an Astronaut" joke, which was scripted, and I couldn't find a place to put it. So I told two of the actors, Kadeem Hardison and Ernie Harden, to go home and come back with as many mama jokes as they could possibly come up with, and I would see if I could build a dueling mama joke, like a dueling banjo, into the rhythm of the scene. So they came back with pages of mama jokes, and most of which are on the cutting room floor, by the way, just for length. I could have done 2 hours of these, and we found a way to work them into the drama so that they are sort of always, there's this ongoing mama joke thing while the rest of the story goes on.
Do you remember how it went with the stuff that you cut out of the movie, that your mama is an astronaut?
Well, I can remember. I mean, your mama's so fat, her blood type's ragu, that kind of stuff that I love. The trick is the rhythms of the movie are real important because I wanted to the dialogue and the whole drama to have basketball rhythms, which are frenetic, kinetic, reverse direction a lot, and not classically dramatic three-act rhythm. So in the mama jokes, I was more concerned with getting two or three or four of them in a row that had a rhythm rather than were they all the best mama jokes I heard. So sometimes the funniest mama joke would be surrounded by three flat mama jokes, and so I would take all of them out. In other words, it's I tell a mama joke, you top me, I top you, you top me, and get out while the rhythm is still alive. So, you know, I've got pages of them written down somewhere, a lot of which I couldn't use on National Public Radio.
I bet. What does that mean, though, your mom is an astronaut? Is that an insult? I didn't get
well,
like,
that's a good question.
The insult?
It's a very good question. I have heard so many absurd insults on the playground that you hardly knew they were insults or not, and that was what that was about. In other words, when in doubt, criticize the guy's mama. That's the basic rule. And if you don't even have a funny joke, criticize her anyway. And any self-respecting playground player will defend his mother. So it all becomes kind of a substitute adversarial issue, really.
My guest is film director Ron Shelton. His new movie, White Men Can't Jump, stars Woody Harrelson and Wesley Snipes. Shelton also wrote and directed Bull Durham and Blaze. And we'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Writer and director Ron Shelton is my guest. Do you watch a lot of basketball on TV? And when you shot your scenes on the court, were there things you wanted to do differently?
I watch a little on TV. I don't have time for a lot. But, you know, I wanted to put the camera where TV cameras couldn't go, which was what my idea about Bull Durham was on a baseball field. On baseball, it has 17 cameras on the World Series. I have two cameras as a filmmaker. But I can put those two where none of the 17 can go. I can go in the locker room, the shower, the pitcher's mound, hear what they're saying out there. I can get in the face of the batter. I could do the same thing with basketball. In other words, we can see what they're saying to each other, and the camera will be right in their face on the court at all times. So that in a certain way, I can't recreate the ballet, but I can show the heart and guts of the sport. And that's what I tried to do.
When you're going to shoot the scenes on the basketball court, do you just let the guys play or do you choreograph them and tell them what to do?
Now, it's all choreographed within an inch of its life in order to look unchoreographed, and that's the real trick. We had a four-week basketball camp with pro coaches. We had a big playbook that I'd worked out with my assistants. There were X's and O's everywhere, and one wonderful thing about working with athletes and athlete actors is that they're used to hitting their marks, especially athletes, and they can do it over and over and over. And we ran plays endlessly. We ran them for days so that to make them look as if they were spontaneous. And that's the whole trick of this kind of choreography, to make it look and feel spontaneous. Because if you just throw up a ball, let them play, there's no way the camera could be in focus and there's no way the camera could follow them.
These matches in the film, these players are extremely good, and they make these amazing shots. Did you have to do a lot of retakes for each scene? Was this really demanding on the players?
I'm glad you asked because, yeah, you have to shoot a lot of footage in basketball or any sports or any action. But one of the fun things was that I could tell all these athletes that for the first time in their life, they could forget all the lessons about fundamental soundness and conservatism that their high school, college, and pro coaches had been drilling into them. All that stuff about no behind-the-back passes, no hot dog moves, nothing, you know, nothing fancy. I said, forget all the coaching you've ever had. Now's the time to pull all these crazy tricks out of your, you know, bag and expand on them. Because the playground's about theater and flamboyance and looking good as much as winning. So it was a chance for a lot of them to cut loose in a way that they'd never been allowed.
You mentioned earlier that you in this film you really wanted to capture kind of the rhythm of a basketball game, and I was thinking about how sports is a lot about timing, and so is comedy, and I was wondering if these two things were ever at odds or if they work together.
Well, I don't think they're at odds. I mean, comic. I think I have a slightly odd sense of comic timing. I mean, I like the laugh to come off the beat a little bit, and I don't write jokes. I always tell the, except for mama jokes, of course, which which are mostly brought to me in bushel loads. I don't write jokes. I try to write behavior and exchanges between people and the conflict out of them. And I always tell the actors to not go for the laugh. Play it real, and the laugh will come wherever it comes. So that that makes the laughs unpredictable, and it makes, hopefully, a movie surprising. But I hate movies that are bam, bam, joke, bam, bam, joke. I think humor's in situation and in human conflict and in the humor of painful situations, not in the formula of a one-liner.
But the actors were going, you know, trying to get the audience to laugh, but they also, their characters were trying to get their friends to laugh at times on the court, too.
Yeah, but that's not classic jokiness. You're right about one thing, though. I mean, in this movie, I could break a couple other rules, too. Normally, you tell your actor, you're hamming it up, or quit trying to steal the part from the other guy. I told them to try to steal the scene from each other every time. Ham it up. Never again will you make a movie where you're allowed to violate all the rules of acting. In other words, stick your face in front of the camera, because that is the theater I'm trying to capture, the theater of the playground. So it was a chance for them to probably go more over the top than they'll ever be allowed to again.
From what I know, Woody Harrelson's father was a contract hitman for the mob, and I think he may even be in prison now, and some people believe that he was in Dallas on the day Kennedy was shot, and that he was one of the three tramps who were just behind the grassy knoll, and it's even possible he might have even shot JFK. And in your movie, the character that Rosie Perez plays, she stays home all day, and she studies all kinds of trivia because she wants to go on Jeopardy, and one of the pieces of information that she's memorizing is about Lee Harvey Oswald shooting JFK. Was that some kind of intentional inside joke for the movie?
No, it wasn't intentional, although it's funny that I've had Kennedy assassination jokes in two of my three movies. Because Lee Harvey, you know, Kevin Costner says Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone in Bull Durham, and now I've got another Lee Harvey Oswald joke in this one. No, it was unintentional, and only later did I find out. I know the story of Woody's troubled background with his father and some of his family, and he's had a difficult background and one with violence in it. Only these rumors about his father's alleged involvement in the assassination I didn't hear about them until after Oliver Stone's movie came out. So that was just one of those fortuitous or miserable accidents.
Well, it's also very ironic that you had Kevin Costner in Bull Durham saying Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone, and then he ends up playing Jim Garrison.
Yeah. I thought it was about the... I didn't want my liberal friends to start falling in love with these characters too much. I wanted to make sure they took enough positions that were politically incorrect and ridiculous.
Why didn't you want your liberal friends to fall in love with your characters?
Because I don't want to write liberal movies or conservative movies or ideological movies. I don't want to be the voice of the right or the left or the middle or anything. I just like to tell stories about human behavior.
You hadn't really been around movie sets much before you directed Bull Durham. Did you feel like you knew what to do when you hit the set?
You never feel like you know what you're doing, believe me. Anybody director who says he does is lying to you. But you got to pretend like you do while you figure out what the hell you're doing. I knew I could tell a story. I knew I could get performances with actors because I like actors. The trick is that when you're directing, you're moving an army, and it's a big, impersonal, logistical job, and you have to keep that army moving incessantly without ever losing the emotional behavior of the story you're telling. So you have to be a aware of these tiny details and nuance of behavior as you're shouting for the tanks to march into the Gulf, you know. And that's really the trick of directing.
How would you characterize your approach as a director? Like, what are the things foremost on your mind, and what do you think is important when you're working with the actors?
To gain their confidence and to build up their confidence. That's the first job of a director. You hire an actor, and you have to then make them believe that they are the best person in the world for that part and that they cannot fail, so that they have the confidence to try things, to relax, to do things that they might otherwise be too afraid of doing. An actor can't do his best if he's afraid. If he's afraid of being fired, if he's afraid of not pleasing the director, if he's afraid of not working, he has to just, it's like an athlete, and it's very much like managing a team. If a guy's going up to the free throw line to shoot and I'm the coach and I say, if you don't make that free throw, I'm going to bench you, the odds diminish that he's going to make it. If I say, you're my guy, make him or miss him, you're my guy, man, a guy's going to can two free throws.
So what are you working on now? What's your next film?
I don't know, but we have a championship basketball game Monday night. That's the most important concern. White Men Can't Jump crew, of which I'm the only white guy on the team, of course, has a game against the Reebok shoe team. And then if we win that, we play the Windy City Five. So I'm just trying to get through the basketball league without getting hurt, and then I'm not sure what I'll do next.
Of course, you don't have the benefit of editing.
No, I would like to take two a few times, believe me.
Okay. Ron Shelton, thanks a lot for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Ron Shelton wrote and directed the film White Men Can't Jump. He spoke with Fresh Air producer Amy Sallet. Shelton wrote the lyrics for a song in the film that's sung by Aretha Franklin. Here it is. The music is by Benny Wallace.
If I lose, if I win, I'm a saint and I've sinned. And this game is getting very, 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 very. Some you give and some you take. I guess I get it wrong.
This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, we're going to talk about politics tonight, about what happened in yesterday's primaries and where the campaign goes from here. We'll also be talking to one of our citizen commentators, a voter, on how the New York primary and other events looked from a distance. We'll have a piece from Britain on Scottish independence. The devolution of Scotland is once again an issue. Hate crimes happening to Asians in the United States, apparently a form of Japan bashing in this country. And, of course, we're leading with the story that the former tennis great Arthur Ashe has contracted the AIDS virus.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This Sunday on competing cable networks, two veteran performers have specials that, among other things, showcase their best-selling album hits from earlier decades. In an intimate Disney Channel special, James Taylor plays old and new songs. On Showtime, there's a solo stage performance from Bob Newhart.
I know some of you know these routines by heart, but it throws me off to watch your lips move along with mine as I'm doing it.
If I had been in the audience that night, I probably would have been mouthing right along. In the early 60s, when I was a kid, I must have played The Button-Down Mind of Bob Newhart more than any other album, at least until the Beatles came along. Our record player was so cheap then, it would wear out the grooves of records we played a lot, and I used to have to stick a penny or a nickel on the tone arm to weigh it down and keep it from popping out. With Bob Newhart's comedy album, I had to use about 85 cents. So to me, and to other longtime Newhart fans, the news of his first full-length stand-up act in 25 years, doing his classic routines, is a genuine big deal. I remember every line. What's more important, so does he. And people who know him only from TV's The Bob Newhart Show and Newhart are going to be impressed all over again. Yet the times have changed, and that makes some of Newhart's old material even more interesting. his piece where the ad agency executive gives campaign advice to Abe Lincoln seemed goofy back then. But today, with every candidate surrounded by handlers and spin doctors, it seems perfectly appropriate. On the other hand, Newhart's classic driving instructor skit is greeted by a slightly different reception in the 90s. But Newhart handles it beautifully.
You're going to have to picture, if you will, this is a car. I'm the driving instructor, and seated next to me is a woman driver. Oh, I heard a little murmur. All right, you... The women in the audience, you feel that this is a sexist routine because it's a woman driving? It was certainly never my intention when I wrote this and performed it 31 years ago. Mrs. Webb is one of my dearest friends, but if some of you find it offensive, it does not have to be a woman driver. I will make it a... I'll make it a Chinese driver. Xiao Ding Old Tall Old Guy. Me, Bao Zhou Hai Yu. Now I can do 8 more minutes of this, or I can make it a woman drive.
Newhart's routines are still very funny after all these years. As proof, here's a quick taste of a routine where a bomb diffusing expert talks by telephone to his man in the field.
Yeah, well, toward the end of it, there's a plate. Do you see the plate held on by 4 screws? Yeah, now, the manual says those screws should be carefully removed with an LT-109 screwdriver with a plastic handle and a demagnetized head. You don't have one, huh, Willard? Well, I'll use a dime then, Willard.
Over on the Disney Channel, the James Taylor Going Home special is a program that, in shorter form, appeared earlier this season on VH1. Taylor and his band set up in a reconverted barn on Martha's Vineyard and run through an hour of old and new material. There are no overdubs. Everybody's there singing and playing at the same time, and the atmosphere is really loose. Taylor plays more than half the songs from his new album, New Moonshine, as well as putting new spins on some old early 70s classics.
Yesterday morning, they let me know you were gone. Suzanne, the plans we made put an end to you.
James Taylor Going Home, like Bob Newhart Off the Record, could work just as well on the radio. But it's nice to see these guys strutting their stuff on TV. They were talented then, and they're talented now.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post.
I've seen fire and I've seen rain. I've seen sunny days and I thought they'd never end. I've seen lonely times and I could not find a friend. But I always.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet Hungarian writer George Conrad. Under communism, his books were banned, but now his work is in bookstores, and he's helping to protect the freedoms of other writers in his capacity as president of PEN, the International Writers Organization. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.